Father, Son, and Holy Ghost.
Hello, friends. Welcome back to our Through the Bible, Through the Year podcast. This is Josh Swanson, lead pastor at Christ Church in Sierra Madre. So today we are coming to the conclusion in our series in Genesis. Next time, we're going to be launching out in Exodus, which I'm really excited about. I love the book of Exodus. And before we conclude Genesis, I wanted to do a summary of the entire book. And sometimes we can miss, you know, the forest for the trees, as they say. We can get so far into the weeds that we miss what the thing is about. And so I want to do kind of a summary of Genesis in 12 minutes. And so here we go. Genesis is divided into two parts. Part one, chapters 1 through 11, deal with the history of the cosmos. And the scope is as broad as everything. It deals with all peoples and all nations and all the families of the earth. You could say that the type of literature we're reading here is archetypal history, or it's mythic history. And by labeling it archetypal or mythic, we're not saying that it's not true, but that it's true in the most profound sense of that word. In other words, these are stories that speak truthfully about who we are and what it means to be human. In other words, you see yourself in these stories, and we are, our own imagination about what it means to be human are shaped by these narratives. And so, like Adam and Eve, we too are created in the divine image. You bear the image of God. You have immense worth and dignity, and you have been given a vocation to steward God's world. And like that first couple, we have been set in the garden, in God's creation, to work it and to keep it. We have purpose and meaning in this world to work God's earth and to create culture. But of course, like Eve, we have turned away from God's good purposes, and we have reached for the forbidden fruit. We have transgressed the boundaries because we have heeded the voice of the deceiver. And like Adam, we have blame shifted. We said, it's not me, it's the woman you gave me. And like that couple, we have found ourselves hiding because we feel naked and ashamed. And like that first couple, though, we also are the recipients of God's passionate pursuit and love, who comes after us in the garden saying, where are you? Seeking to draw us out and find us out. And like that original couple, we have come underneath the judgment of God, and we have been cast out of the garden of God. And you could say one of the things that it means to be human is to be people who are in exile far away from Eden. We are estranged. We are homeless. That is, we find ourselves estranged from our true home, which is God and that perfect fellowship with God that God created us for in the beginning. And, you know, like Cain, we get jealous of our brother or our sister, and we find ourselves getting bitter because it seems like life is unfair, and this person is succeeding, and I'm not, and why them and not me? And we get bitter, and we become in danger of having sin like a crouching lion at the door waiting to pounce us and have that bitterness get a hold of our lives. And yet, a little bit later, we humans are not all just beast and broken. We also continue to reflect the divine image. And so, like, you know, in that first genealogy, like Enoch, we have built cities that are beautiful. And like Lamech, we have written poetry. And like Jabal, we've developed instruments of farming and agriculture. And like Tubal-Cain, we have been forgers of instruments of bronze, and we have cultivated technology. And like Jubal, we have made musical instruments, and we have made music. And yet, like the other genealogy in chapter 5, we are still subject to death. And even our cultural development seems to come to nothing, because we ultimately die. We are subject to death. And like, you know, the world at the time of the flood, our world is flooded with violence. And this, in some sense, is the best word to describe the history of the human race. We have been a violent people, and we are subject to God's judgment because of our violence. And, you know, like those early tower builders, you know, we have aspired to make a name for ourselves, and we have resisted God's call upon our lives. And so we find ourselves in these narratives. These narratives have us written all over. And so they are archetypal in that sense. But these texts are also polemical in the sense that they are seeking to challenge alternate views of God in the ancient world. You know, according to the ancient imagination, the gods were crazy. And you can know why. You look at the volcano, it's erupting. What caused it? You know, and the crops failed this year. Why? You know, and what where did this hurricane come from? And why did my son die so early? And they found themselves subject to these forces outside of themselves. And they believed the universe to be inhabited, as it were, by almost like these sky fairies, these gods that were chaotic and arbitrary, often violent, very immoral or amoral. And in the ancient imagination, you know, religion wasn't primarily about morality and ethics. We think today about, you know, religious people being more moral people, or they should be more moral. But in the ancient world, that was the realm of the philosophers. Religion was more about magic. It was like more about controlling the forces of nature, getting the gods on your side, or getting the gods against your neighbor, or getting the gods to give you a child. And how do you do that? Well, you got to pacify them, and they're chaotic and they're unpredictable. And in the midst of this polytheistic world, like a bolt of lightning, comes a new vision of God in these ancient stories. And it's a vision of God that is creator. There is one God, not many. And this God is not chaotic, and he is not immoral or amoral. He is good and just. And this God is all powerful. He is not one of the many, you know, things that exist out in, you know, the supernatural realm. He is the ground of all that exists. He is infinite goodness and infinite power and infinite being in his own self. And out of the wellspring of his own existence and life, he calls into being all things that are. And this God is not just transcendent and holy other. He is also close and personal. I mean, this is the irony of these texts. God is utterly transcendent and beautiful and holy other and all powerful. And yet, there he is in the garden, on his knees, with his hands in the dirt, touching the dust, forming the clay, walking in the garden in the cool of the day. This is a God who desires to get close to his creation, close to his human creatures. And God, of course, is the judge of all the earth. This is what the flood narrative is intended to communicate to us, is that the world is accountable to God, and that God is just, and that human life is full of sanctity, and it must be honored and treasured because humans are created in the image of God. And so they will be held to account. We will be held to account for how we treat other humans. And so these texts are intended to be polemical, challenging alternate views of God. And so that's Genesis 1 through 11, archetypal mythic history, polemical, intended to shape our view of God and reform our view of ourselves. The second half of Genesis, though, the focus shifts dramatically. And you go from all peoples and all nations to one man and one nation, namely Abraham and Israel. The focus shifts from the history of the cosmos to the history of the covenant promise of God. And in these texts, God approaches, you know, the transcendent creator approaches in a very personal way a couple in the ancient world, Abraham and Sarah. And he promises that from this couple, he is going to form this multitudinous nation that will be as many as the stars of the sky and the sand on the seashore. And he says, I'm going to bless this multitudinous nation. And then he says, I'm going to give them land. And then through this nation, all the families of the earth will be blessed. And so God comes to Abraham with this covenant, and then he cuts the covenant in Genesis 15, and he divides these animal carcasses, and he walks through the middle of these carcasses saying, here is what will happen to me, the true and living God, if I am unfaithful to my covenant promise. May I be torn apart like these animals. And he covenants himself to being the God who keeps his promise. And then a little later in Genesis 17, he gives Abraham the sign of the covenant, which is circumcision, saying that forever you, my people, will be marked as people of the covenant promise. And God comes again and again and again in these narratives to Abraham and to his sons, repeating his promise. And so, for example, after Genesis 12 and 15 and 17, God comes again in Genesis 22 to Abraham, and he says this, I swear by myself, declares the Lord, that because you have done this and have not withheld your son, your only son, I will surely bless you and make your descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky and as the sand on the seashore. Your descendants shall take possession of the cities of their enemies, and through your offspring, all the families of the earth will be blessed because you have obeyed me. And he repeats this promise to Isaac in Genesis 26, Abraham's son. The Lord appeared to Isaac and said, do not go down to Egypt. Live in the land where I tell you to live. Stay in this land for a while, for I will be with you and bless you. For to you and your descendants, I will give all of these lands, and I will confirm the oath, the promise I swore to Abraham, your father. And I will make your descendants as numerous as the stars of the sky. You hear an echo of the words that were made before, and I will give them all of these lands, and through your offspring, all of the nations of the earth will be blessed. And he doesn't just repeat this to Abraham and to Isaac, but also to Jacob. There's this great dream that Jacob has, the famous Jacob's ladder. And there above the ladder stood the Lord, and he said, I am the Lord, the God of your father, Abraham, and the God of Isaac. And he says this, I will give to you and your descendants the land on which you are lying. And your descendants will be like the dust of the earth, and you will spread out west and east and north and south, and all the peoples of the earth will be blessed through you and your offspring. I am with you and will watch over you wherever you go. And so these chapters tell the building out of God's promise and how God reiterates this promise. And it's about, can this new family that he's forming trust in his promise? And will they live as people of the promise? And for the most part, the jury is out on that question by the time the story ends. I mean, this family is a mixed bag. Clearly, if God is going to keep his promise, it's going to be by God's grace toward this broken people. I mean, even the father of the nation, you know, the father of the 12 tribes, Jacob, whose name is turned to Israel, his name means heel catcher or deceiver, almost like echoing back to the serpent in the garden, you know. He's got issues. And yet God's promise is to take this family and to form them into a different kind of people, forever speaking to us this word that God always will begin with us where we are at, in his grace, and he will take us where we are at to where he wants us to go. And so this is what Genesis 12 through 50 is about. It's about the history of the promise. But these two parts, part one and part two, are held together in this. The promise God makes to Abraham and repeats to Isaac and then reiterates to Jacob, this promise that he will make them great and bless them, is always intended to be for something more than just this family. God's intention that's made clear is that through this family, he will bring his blessing to all of the families of the earth. And that's why the choice of Abraham in Genesis 12, this one man, this one family, is set against the backdrop of Genesis 10 and 11, which give us the history of all the families of the earth. To say this broken humanity that I spoke to you about in Genesis 1 through 11 is gonna ultimately be the recipients of God's gracious work to bring blessing to all the families of the earth again. God will deal with the problem of curse in Genesis 3, and the spread of sin and death in Genesis 4 and 5 and 6. And God will bring back to his humanity the blessing through the descendants or through the seed of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. And then this, Matthew 1:1 opens this way. It says, "The good news of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham." Jesus is marked out as being the one through whom God will ultimately bring his healing and his salvation and his blessing to the broken humanity that stands under the curse. And then in Matthew 28, at the very end of the Gospel of Matthew, Jesus says this. He says, "All authority in heaven and on earth is given to me." In other words, the cosmic authority, the authority of God that calls all things into being, Jesus says, that authority is vested in me. And then he says, "And now go therefore and make disciples of" who? Notice the seed of Abraham, Jesus, says, "Go and make disciples of all the families of the earth." And so God's call to Abraham and Isaac and Jacob was always intended to take us ultimately to this point when God's promise would take on flesh and blood in Jesus, the one who would be the true bearer of God's blessing to all of the families of the earth. And there it is, Genesis in summary, not quite 12 minutes. I think it was closer to about 15, but hopefully that's helpful to you as you're seeking to kind of like think through this. Think about part 1, 1 through 11, part 2, 12 to 50, and how part 1 and part 2 connects. The promise is intended to bring the blessing to all the families of the earth. And of course, the rest of the Old Testament is going to be the story of how God is going to continue to build out that promise to this nation and fill it in so many interesting and fascinating ways, and then ultimately bring it to its culmination, its climax in Jesus, who is the climax of the covenant promise of God.
Praise Father, Son, and Holy.